Here.
Debbie Harry.
Here.
Dan Morris, absent. Two members are present, which constitutes four.
All right, please join us in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And if I may have a motion to approve the minutes for our last meeting of August 20th, subject to any amendment?
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Financial report, please.
Thank you, Commissioners. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry about the delay. We're just getting our clicker working. Okay, so there we go. Very good. So these numbers are through August 31st of this year. Excuse me, I'm going to remove my mask briefly. As we can see here, we have not yet received the last property tax settlement payment, so we're down a little bit over $17 million from where we were last year. The estimated timeline is by September 30th, so we're expecting to receive notification within the next week or so. We'll obviously keep an eye on this, but there's been no change to the estimated amount that we're going to receive. So we should still be getting an amount that brings us close to in line with last year. Looking at our charges for services, we are down about $8.1 million. We'll talk about where that is. Well, what's interesting is when we first did our scenario planning back in March, middle of March, end of March, we did four scenarios, and those scenarios suggested that we were going to be down in revenue between about $5.5 million and about $13.6 million. So we're trending more towards the $11 to $13 million side, but even back then with all the unknowns, we had measures that we were able to take for each of those respective layers to offset that, and we're still seeing that here when we look at our costs. We're doing a great job offsetting that lost revenue component. The total revenue that we're down is just under $23 million. Again, 17.3 of that is because of the tax timing. When we look at our operating expenses, this is where you can see those offsets. We've saved about $11 million versus our operating expenses last year, roughly 50% in our people costs and 50% in our operations. So the park just continues to do a great job doing more with less and managing costs very closely. And then from an operating surplus perspective, this puts us about $11.6 million behind where we were last year. So we're actually, if you factor in the property tax timing from a operating surplus perspective, we're doing a little bit better than last year because of all of our discipline. We have gone ahead and done well with our capital side. We spent about $4.7 million more than last year. We do continue that capital investment. We've also raised $3 million more in grants and donations this year that are a lot of other people's money funding these projects. For the capital side, we're being very diligent in using other people's money as the priority for when we look at our capital project projections and what we expect to complete this year. And then from a net surplus perspective, you can see the overall is a $16 million shortfall versus last year. And again, 17.3 comes back when we get our taxes. So we're really comparable from a net effect on our cash position to where we were last year. So we're pretty proud of that given all the challenges this year. As we move to the zoo, we see that our revenue is about $4.5 million behind where it was last year. You see the asterisk here. We did make a payment to our partner Tianyu of $535,000. That's going to be reflected in the September numbers that are not in these August numbers. However, just yesterday we received a check from the Zoo Society for $500,000, so that offsets. So this really is a pretty good indicator of where we are in terms of our revenue from year over year through August. And again, it's a little bit more challenging with the fixed cost to offset all of the lost revenue on the zoo side, but they're doing a really great job managing very tightly and have spent $2.2 million less than they did last year. So our operating subsidy is about $2.3 million greater than it was through August of 2019. And then when we look at our capital side, again, we do have we had a significant project with the Rainforest Dome, which by the way, turned out fantastic for anyone that has seen it. It was just remarkable. We have spent about $810,000 more on the capital side than we did through this point last year at the zoo. And our net subsidy is about $3.1 million greater than where it was last year through August. Moving on to golf, Again, it's just hard to say enough about how exceptional this year has been for golf. They're up $674,000 in revenue, and it's driven completely by the greens fees and the equipment rentals. Just remarkable. The entire team, obviously Sean and certainly all the managers, the courses, and all of our staff, they're working really hard. It's been 27% increase in rounds played this year. We're seeing an increase in some of our courses that are shorter, suggesting that newer people are taking up the game. For instance, Mastic and Washington. So we'll see those numbers on the individual course basis coming up. But it's really exciting with what they've been able to accomplish this year so far. Even better is the fact that with over $670,000 of increased revenue, we still have a decrease in expenses of $429,000. Usually, when you see the revenue go up, you have to invest on the expense side to drive that revenue. But this has been a real yeoman's effort on behalf of the entire team to carry this load. And it's not sustainable. Well, this is really hard on people, so it's not like we can run at this kind of a clip year over year. But it really shows how when we need to be focused in a point like this, that the team's been able to execute. So we're really proud of them. On the net surplus side, we are ahead a ton, $2.1 million. You can see that our capital investment is lighter than it was last year. We didn't have significant projects planned now that we've come off of all three phases of Seneca. We did invest in Washington in the driving range nets and some other things throughout a couple of the courses on a little smaller scale this year. We will have to focus on making sure we keep up with all capital going forward too. So this has been a little bit of a intentional deferment this year, but we'll continue to keep those courses in pristine condition. Moving on to the per course results. Now you can see all the courses are in green, which means both revenue and operating surplus are greater than last year at this point in time. What's even more impressive, Sleepy Hollow and Seneca have now crested over $1 million in revenue for the year. And we've got three other courses, Big Met, Manakiki, and Shawnee, that are knocking at the door at north of 900,000. So tremendous. I mean, just we've had great support from the community and great interest in playing the game. Looking at enterprise, slightly different story, as you know. The revenue is down $3.4 million, driven by our concessions having Merwin's closed through August. We had a little bit of revenue from Merwin's. I believe we'll see on the next slide. I think it was a little over 100,000 in the first quarter of the year, first 2.5 months really, but that's been it since the closure. We just did the announcement that we are opening the patio and grab and go or carry out as of September 10th. So that's fresh. We had a great weekend, the initial weekend after that rolled out with terms of number of reservations of folks that came out to support. So we're a little optimistic that will start driving a little better activity. We have had some positive activity at Edgewater Beach House, but obviously much less than last year, which with not having Edgewater Live and being closed for much of the season, but we'll look at those as well. But those are really what's driving a lot of our $3 million shortfall here in terms of revenue. We have been able to offset $2.5 million of that by expense control. Again, this is also largely split between the salaries and benefits line and the operations line. And that puts us in an operating subsidy position that's about $966,000 behind where we were last year. So really driven by the inability to open up some of our facilities. And as we go down to the net subsidy position, you can see that we have not done a tremendous amount of capital investment. We're pretty comparable to where we were last year. So this puts our net surplus at a $933,000 number greater than where it was last year. Excuse me, net subsidy greater than where it was last year at this time for the enterprise operations. And then moving to our by location information. Again, items in gray are not open, will be shortly at Merwin's. When we look at the Emerald Necklace Marina, that is doing a little bit better this year than last. When we look at East 55th Marina and Wildwood, we are stronger on the operating surplus side. We're a little bit behind on the operating revenue side. And then when you look at Wildwood specifically, that's just about break even. It's slightly under break even. And when we look at the Beach House, East 55th Restaurant, and Emerald Necklace Restaurant, obviously those results are all behind last year simply because we have not been open for most of the season. We got a partial season out of East 55th. And really, when you think about the limited amount of time and the fact that we really just did patio and grab and go at East 55th, I'm pretty pleased with where these numbers have come in so far, $286,000 in revenue through August.
I was going to comment on that, too. I mean, East 55th was closed for a little while, and now it's certainly limited capacity, although it's been pretty good, pretty full every time I've been over there, so that's fantastic that the numbers are that well.
You're absolutely right. That patio setup over there is really nice. There's room to spread, and that's really helped out a lot. And again, grateful that the community's been so supportive. There's definitely interest in getting out and utilizing it. Now we're shifting that, right? So East 55th is closing for the season, and we're moving that operation effectively over to Merwin. So hopefully we can get the same level of activity over in Merwin's.
Yeah, that's great.
And again, just looking at the closed locations, locations that are, this is interesting. So Edgewater Pier, you can see we've only done about 40 grand in revenue versus 91 last year, but we are just slightly ahead from an operating surplus side. So we haven't spent much money there at all from operating expense perspective. So it's actually still kicking off a surplus, as is Huntington. Huntington is down to about $83,000 in revenue versus the 146 last year. And remember, last year Huntington was down because there's no beach,
right?
So it's so concessions have been limited. This year season was even shortened more because we didn't open it right away, but it still has produced a $22,500 operating surplus versus the $14,800 at this point last year. So so discipline is kind of the recurring theme. Now, looking ahead, well, we can obviously Wallace Lake and parking too, we've talked about those, so there's not a whole lot more we can say on that. But again, both surplus positions from an operating perspective. Looking ahead, it was pretty interesting. So we're obviously trying to determine what to expect for 2021 and what the impact is going to be, if any, on our property tax levy revenue. So this is specifically just property tax levy revenue that's shown in this bar graph, represented by the green, yellow, and blue. So there are no Homestead Act or rollback monies included in this. It's just truly based on the real estate tax. And the yellow bar represents 2008, which was the beginning of the economic collapse when we had our Great Recession. And then the blue bars are the property tax revenues that we received in the succeeding 5 years after that. The red line is a line that represents the U.S. single family mortgage delinquency rate across the country. So this is not specific to Ohio. It's from the Federal Reserve System Board of Governors, and this is based on a U.S. average. So you can see that it was roughly 3.25% in 2007, and between 2008 and 2009, it jumped up to 10%, which it carried on for roughly 3 years or so, 3.5 before it started its decline. So it was a pretty rough period of time. So in looking at this, we had some level of concern about whether we're going to experience the same thing should we hit an increase in mortgage delinquencies that are forecasted for 2021 and 2022. However, when we look at this, we can see that even though the revenue has decreased in 2009 through 2013 following the 2008 period of time, what's really interesting is this. If we look at our effective tax collection rates, they did not waver a ton. They were just under 98% in 2007 and 2008. They went down to 96 in the 96s in 09 and 10. And then you can see they bottomed at just over 95% in 11 and 12 and got back to 96% in 13. So the second question is, if that's the case and we're only talking about a point and a half, maybe two in terms of collection rates, what's driving the decrease in revenue? That is also something that was remarkable about 2008 and very different from now, is the fact that the real estate value bubble burst. And in our triennials, 2009 was a revaluation year and 2012 was a revaluation year. So this is a direct result of having those depressed market values. House Bill 920 doesn't allow us to realize appreciation in market value, but there is the ability for us to be penalized or hurt by devaluation in the marketplace. That's exactly what happened here. So today's circumstances, we do not have this real estate bubble that we can foresee crashing like the real estate values did in 9 through 13. What we do see is increased single dwelling purchases right now. We don't know how long that's going to sustain. But because of this economic pressure, or the pressure on our current economy, is because of a very singular, isolated, acute event. It's much different than 2008. So our expectation is this: when we're looking at our projections, at least right now for 2021, we are coming off of about a 98.2% collection rate. I think we're projecting it to come down to a 96% projection rate, just out of some level of conservatism. And what that means is a $1.5 million reduction in property tax revenues in 2021. So not catastrophic, something for us to manage through. We're building our projections based on that assumption right now. And if anything changes between now and then, obviously we'll continue to update that. But it gave us a little bit more comfort and insight as to what drove the downward pressure in 2008's impact versus what's going to happen from the 2020 impact.
I guess our only concern is we really don't know long-term because we just don't know how long this will stay and where it'll go and that.
That's 100% right.
No way to know, huh? But that's good news for next year. At least we feel confident.
I mean, it sounds like it's going to be another year by the time all vaccines and distribution.
Right, really get out. And
It's going to be probably at least another year. The Fed just released today that they're expecting to have near zero interest rates for the next 3 years through 2023. Even if unemployment goes down to 4% and inflation goes up to 2%, they want to hold rates. But they also did say they're revising their projection on unemployment from 9 to 10% down to 7 to 8%, so that was slightly encouraging. But there's these various indicators that we're seeing that makes it really difficult. I mean, number one, we haven't been through this before. Number two, you've got conflicting indicators to really suggest what's going to happen. So we're going to continue to do what we've done from March and scenario plan, where we do our worst, our best, our expected, and an outlier, just that, you know, catastrophic, and keep managing within each of those particular models. And as we see our movement towards one or another, we have prescribed steps that we can take within each of those to make the adjustments. So it's worked for us to this point, and we're gonna continue with that discipline.
Very thorough. Thank you.
Yeah, that was really helpful and really good.
Great. Thank you very much. If there's no questions, we're all set.
Thanks for that information.
Thank you.
Hey, Brian.
Good morning, everyone. We have the very first action item is the 2020 budget adjustment number 8. Bill?
Don't go away.
Anybody else needed the clicker, so I'm just going to go ahead and deliver that. This budget adjustment number 8 is a $214,266 adjustment. $102,000 of this is out of restricted funds for the Acacia development, and $112,000 of this is from the ODNR NatureWorks grant for several projects. So that makes up the vast majority of this. Again, these are additional monies coming in. We are not just increasing the spend side. The resources are going up as well. So we recommend that the Board of Park Commissioners approve the 2020 budget adjustment number 8 for a total increase of $214,266. And the detail is on pages 35 to 36.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item is the authorization for Cleveland Metro Parks to open and maintain one or more accounts with Huntington National Bank.
Pursuant to the awarding of the depository Huntington services for Huntington National Bank, when we just did our banking RFP 6499, we are required to open and maintain new Huntington accounts, and we require authorization from the board to do so. And you can see there are several items here that we are including in this action, many of which are basically representations to Huntington National Bank. We comply with all of these. So we also name our authorized signatories. We have those that are consistent with what we did with our last accounts. There's no changes. So it's Brian as CEO, myself as CFO, Gary Butzbach, our controller, Dana Scully, our Director of Accounting and Financial Services, and Joe Rozek as our COO. So that way, if anybody's out of the office, we have a chain of command we can follow, and it doesn't necessarily stop our progress. So based on all of this, if there's no questions on the stipulations within the action item, our recommendation is that we go ahead and the Board of Commissioners approves this awarding of the ability to open and maintain our bank accounts with Huntington National Bank.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Next action item is the authorization of the 2021 tax levy amounts and rates.
By statute, we are required to adopt a resolution that, number one, accepts the tax amounts and rates determined by the Cuyahoga County Budget Commission, and number two, authorizes the county to levy those necessary taxes. There is no change within where we're at from our current levy. We continue to have an inside millage rate of 0.05 and an outside millage rate of 2.7. So we will get the estimated amount of monies from the levies in mid-December this year. We don't have that yet. That's consistent. We typically do receive it then, so that's no change in timing. So the recommended action is that the Board of Park Commissioners approve this resolution above.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the 2021 Cleveland Metro Parks Employee Group Healthcare Benefits Plan. Harold and Matt have been working diligent with our provider, our benefits consultant Oswald, and Matt is here to present to us the 2021 Healthcare Group Plan benefits.
Morning, Commissioner.
Morning.
So in what some of my been a somewhat difficult year from an HR perspective, this has been a bright spot for us, and so we do have some good news.
By way of background, though, we do manage our primary spend in our health insurance program is on our self-insured medical plan. And so at a size plan that we are about 550 employees, self-insured is a financially prudent route to go. We're able to bank any sort of, instead of profits, we bank that as a reserve. And in comparison to the market, we've consistently determined that that's a much better option than going fully insured. But we do purchase a catastrophic stop-loss insurance to protect us from significant claims. And that deductible currently is $175,000 per claim. And there's an aggregate umbrella of 125% over the entire plan. For example, this year we do have a claim that's north of $500,000. So that $175,000 deductible has saved the plan upwards of $325,000 this year alone. So it's a valuable piece. It is expensive. It's close to $1 million in premium we pay for that, but it is essential to have that to protect the fiscal responsibility of the Park District. We do contract with the medical insurance carrier Cigna currently for access to their network discounts, claims management support programs. So from an employee user standpoint, it appears that Cigna is our insurance carrier, but we do pay those claims on the back end. We offer three plans for employees, a high deductible health savings account plan C. We have a base PPO plan and then a buy-up PPO plan, which is probably the most popular plan, which is a lower deductible, higher premium plan. And depending on their union status, employees contribute between 5 and 18% of the premium costs towards purchasing their insurance. So again, at a plan size of 550, self-insured is the right route to go. However, there can be volatility at that size. And we did see some of that throughout the years. And so this is a look at our paid claims from 2013 through projected end of year this year. As you can see, we peaked out in 2016 at 7.6 million. And we have, as I said, this is positive news today, we've seen a continuing decline for the past 4 years, and we are actually expecting to be somewhere south of 5 million this year in claims. So a significant reduction over this period of time. As I said, when we, each year we set a premium rate, we collect that from employees and from departments into the self-insured fund. When we perform better than expected, we recoup that money as reserve fund. When we perform worse than expected, that money is paid out to cover claims. So if we were to put on this chart sort of a mirror image of the reserve fund, you would see that our reserve fund slowly built through the lower claims years. But when we hit that 2016 peak, we actually went into a negative $1 million balance in the reserve fund. So we had to borrow from the general fund. What I can say though is that between the way we've set premiums and our performance on claims, that reduction that we've seen in the last 4 years, we have paid back all of the debt to the general fund, and we are sitting with a very positive reserve fund balance now, somewhere north of $5 million at this point in the reserve fund currently as of today. So that's happened even faster than we could have expected it to, and it's really a multi-faceted approach as to how we've gotten there. So when we want to...
Can I ask you, is there any predictability to that decrease or not?
This is what I was going to get to next. There is an element of luck. At a 550 employee population, we are what we would be considered not credible in the sense that, you know, if you're talking about a 10,000 employee plan, you're going to see a very steady increment one way or the other in your plan. We are going to see ebbs and flows. There's things that are out of our control, cancer cases that are non-preventable, other situations, high-risk childbirth situations that we've seen over the years that can skew the plan up and down in a particular year. In 2016, we saw some, you know, I think we had 8 catastrophic claims that year. So we do look at the long game, though, and there are incremental things that we do think flatten that line and do lower that line over time. Because we still, like I mentioned, we have a $500,000 claim this year, but we're at potentially our lowest total claim number in, you know, 7 years. So it's two-sided. We know there's luck because I could be standing here in 2 years with claims looking another direction, and I don't want to say that we caused that. So it's, there is a balance there. But what we think we've done over the past 4 years is we've taken some strong measures to cause that curve to flatten downward. First, our health engagement partnership with Cigna. We actually started with Cigna in 2016, and the first year was a little scary because that's when we saw our claim spike. But the work that we do with Cigna is not intended to just flip things around in 1 year. It's more of a long-term strategy. And it's really that health engagement partnership with Cigna and the work that they do with us and with our employees to get them engaged in their health. And that's a long-term strategy. Wellness isn't something that flips your claims in a year. It's something that over the course of 5, 10, 15 years, we hope to flatten that trend. And so what I've passed out to you before the meeting today is Cigna has actually reached out to us, and they're engaging us as a case study as one of their most successful partnerships and engagement and engaging employees. And so this is a draft document that they're producing from their end to sort of show how our relationship with Cigna has helped lower that premium trend. And you can see our employees are generally, in general, have always been a very engaged population, but now with Cigna working with us, we've got employees 70%+ seeking wellness visits. That's 20% above the book of business norm for Cigna. We have chronic health condition medication adherence above the norm. We have a 93% generic prescription rate. The consumer-based decision support, so an example of that is with Cigna, we have a prior approval for an MRI required. Instead of just sending you a letter saying you're approved for your MRI, Cigna is going to call you and say, by the way, if you want to get this MRI, there's an independent lab down the street that does this for half the cost. And they're going to, you know, it's your choice, but they're going to get in front of you to help you make that choice. And so these are those incremental things that can help flatten those costs that we can control. We know there's going to be costs that we can't control from time to time, but the ones we can, generic prescription rates, steerable ER visits. We're doing a great job of controlling those costs. One of the reasons we did switch to Cigna was we were having difficulty with our prior carrier, Medical Mutual, with administrative support. Cigna's customer service has been top notch over the past 4 years. We've actually leveraged that to reduce an FTE count in HR. We had a person dedicated to employee concerns and complaints and resolving issues. That has become virtually obsolete with Cigna. They have 24/7 customer service. They're very prompt in their responses. So we've actually reduced, we took another employee and added that function to their function. So it's really been remarkable from us from an administrative standpoint too. So those are costs that you don't even see in the healthcare budget, but that we're saving, you know, $70,000 a year by not having that position filled. We have done taken a cautious approach to premium pricing. We've leveraged that premium pricing a little higher than what, you know, the actuarials would have assessed our plan at to build that reserve. So we built a little cushion into the premiums, both for departments and employees. And at the same time, over the past 5 years, we have right-sized our plan from the perspective of deductibles and co-pays. We've become much more aligned with the market. So there's a more equitable cost-sharing balance, and that has helped defray some of the costs on the plan. And a big impact from our perspective is a spousal redirection. So 2 years ago, we implemented a spousal surcharge, and we went to a three-tier premium structure. So employee, employee plus children and family. And what we've seen is we've seen 16.4% reduction in spouses on the plan. And our research showed that spouses were significantly more costly to our plan than our own employees. And so those spouses weren't uninsured. They weren't kicked off the plan, but they were moved to their own employment plan. So it's more of an equitable distribution of that risk to other employers. And so that has played a part in this cost reduction over the past 2 years. So that brings us to our action item for 2021. We believe that there is no need to increase the medical premiums. Again, they were at a point that was covering us from a reserve standpoint over the past 2 years. We have built that reserve. We think that if claims continue on current trend, we will even put more money into the reserve next year. However, worst case scenario, we do experience that catastrophic year. We have that stop loss umbrella insurance that would cap us at about a $1.1 million loss against the $5 million reserve. And that's a risk that is very reasonable to take. We are holding off on bringing the stop loss insurance to the board. That will come in October as a separate action item. We are still in negotiations with carriers. Because of that high claim, we are not seeing, carriers do not want to commit to a price yet. They're kind of watching that claim to see what's going to happen going into next year. So that's an issue. And then there is also the issue of there was that 2-month sort of anomaly where hospitals were essentially closed. And so we saw a bottoming out of claims. So the data is really unreliable right now. So they want a couple more months of current data to see if there's a rebound effect. So we hope to have firm bids by the end of September to bring back. We have an idea of where it's going to be. We have some good competitive bids. So it's not going to be catastrophic. It's going to be a reasonable increase in stop loss. Our dental insurance and vision insurance are fully insured. So we just pay a premium. We take no risk in those programs. We have vision locked in at a flat rate. We have dental between a 0 and 3.92 rate cap increase. We're still negotiating. We are trying to leverage the fact that dental usage has been very far down because of COVID to get to that 0%, but we're asking for the authority to negotiate within that range going forward. Any questions?
No, it's very good.
Yeah, it's good overview.
Very informative.
Positive. Just as we go to approve this, again, I have to thank Matt and Harold and the entire team, as well as every Cleveland Metro Parks employee. I mean, they're all part of this. And when you look at Cigna as a national carrier and they're looking to highlight the Park District, that's a
poster child.
That's a very big deal for the work that we're doing. And certainly looking at the numbers, I'm looking at where we can do better. And preventative wellness care was one of the focuses that Harold and I first looked at. I think, what was the number when we first got here?
21%.
We're only getting physicals, 21% of our staff.
Wow.
And we've increased that number exponentially, and we still have some work to do, but we know that on the front end, someone in this office, someone sitting here was one of them. But we've worked very hard at actually getting all of our people into the doctor and having a critical care. What that actually did was people's primary doctors were becoming the ER, and so they were going to the ER instead of actually going to their primary care doctor. And so once we've gotten those relationships solidified more, we've been able to build off of that each and every year. And so it's a great success story of what's been able to do here. We were one of the first to pilot the Teladoc type program,
right.
And that's continued to work out very well, the generic prescription. So I just have to say we've been very progressive on our healthcare. It is a cost that we bear. It is something that this team has taken very seriously to work with and provide good quality insurance to our employees. So again, I want to thank everyone that's been part of this process, because it's a lot of people that need to participate to make this work.
Yeah, that shows.
Great.
So the recommended action falls on, it's a large one, starts on page 13 and carries itself through for the 2021 healthcare group employee benefits.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Very good.
Thank you.
We will let you two go.
Yes, thank you very much. Good. Good news.
If Sean is out there, he can come in. The next action item we have is through the Cleveland Metro Parks Zoo, Cleveland Metro Parks, the Brighton Park Lease and Management Agreement. This is really by way of background facilitating the Big Creek Trail Connector. This is site improvements at Brighton Park. This is an agreement, project development agreement that has been struck with Western Reserve Land Conservancy, Old Brooklyn Development Corporation. Bruce, I think you and I toured this maybe back in 2011.
Hard to believe, but yeah, back then.
It was about that long.
Councilman Simperman was.
Yep. Progress does take time, but we were able to partner with Western Reserve Land Conservancy, take over what is formerly known as the old Henninger Landfill. It is now being called Brighton Park. It's approximately 24.5 acres. It is in the Old Brooklyn neighborhood of Cleveland, and it is working to connect our Cleveland Metro Park Zoo to the towpath. We are also working with our partners at West Creek Conservancy and looking at the Treadway Trail connection and really trying to solidify the management structure for the trail system all the way down to the towpath. What is also very unique about this lease and management agreement Western Reserve Land Conservancy has agreed to remit to Cleveland Metro Parks $10,000 annually for the management fee and the ability to help operate Brighton Park. The board, the recommended action falls if there are no questions on the bottom part of page 16, and the trail and trail system is being built currently on site, making the connection.
Fantastic. Move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the adoption of the revised policy of dignity and respect for all, inclusion, diversity, equity, and the accessibility policy. Rose?
Thanks, Brian. This is loud.
Good morning.
Good morning. We feel passionately about diversity, and that's why we're very loud. But we saw the first reading of the revised policy last month, and we're doing two readings, just as a reminder, because our bylaws say that when we have substantial changes to a policy, we need the two full readings. So today represents the second time it's before the board, and we'd look for approval of the revised policy. We went over a couple of the policy's new provisions last time, and the board had some questions. Bruce, we supplied some information regarding how components of that policy fall into those four categories.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also our planning and design team also gave us some examples of how we all already are incorporating a lot of the concepts of equity, inclusion, and diversity and accessibility in our planning processes. And we'll continue to do so, and that is also a requirement of the revised policy. So we feel we're very well on our way, and we look forward to Harold's presentation during the information item, talking about how our consultant will also help operationalize this policy.
Recommended action falls on the bottom portion of page 17, revising the dignity and respect for all policy.
Move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The next action item is change order number one, contract 1520, Whiskey Island Connector Trail at the Lakefront Reservation. This contract was awarded through the Mark Haynes Construction. Cleveland Metro Parks did partner with the City of Cleveland Division of Water for the replacement of a water main. This change order is solely directed towards the work that is being done in partnership with the City of Cleveland's Water Division. It is a change order in the amount of $125,034.91. Again, this will be remitted to Cleveland Metro Parks from the City of Cleveland. Recommended falls in the bottom portion of page 18.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The next action item, Sean, if you want to step out and we will have the chief come in. The next action item is the authorization for Cleveland Metro Parks to enter into a new member participation agreement with the Chagrin Valley Dispatch Council. This goes without saying, this was a very hard decision, a very tough decision. We not only looked at it from many different angles from our current dispatching situation, which has been with us for as long as the police department has been here. They have done a very solid job for Cleveland Metro Parks, and I want to thank each and every one of them. Chief Dolan has worked with all of them to get time over at the Chagrin Valley Dispatch headquarters over in Brecksville. We have also gotten almost more than 90% of our staff. Police force has gone through Chagrin Valley. I have made at least a half a dozen phone calls to chiefs all over Cuyahoga County, some that are with, some that are not with, and really looked at the validity of being able to go to more of a regionalized situation. Now, we are a regional system. We cover a wide swath. We cover five counties. And so we're very mindful of the position that Metro Parks has had for many, many years. But we looked at all of the technology and the ability to collaborate more. We also have looked at how funding will go forward in the future. And that is one of the concerns. When you're isolated as one, you will be looked at as one versus more of a regional and the assets that are available. So again, I want to say that Chief Dolan, Lieutenant Chabitzer, the entire team has taken a full view and full look at this And it is a recommended action to move into the Council of Governments, of which I will be a member of the executive team. Chief Dolan will be a member of her chief-level team, and then I believe one officer will be a member of that as well.
Correct.
Chief, anything you'd like to add?
No, we brought the information to you last month in regards to moving to CVD. We've done our due diligence, and we have, like Brian said, over 90% of the police department, as well as we gave the opportunity to all of the dispatchers to go through and shadow, meet the people there, see the equipment, learn how they do things. And I feel strongly that this will be great for the park and for the police department and our officers as well.
You know, I'd just like to comment sort of anecdotally. When Mayfield Village was looking at this several years ago, I was still mayor, and smaller, but still the same kind of sensitivity that you don't want to lose quality in terms of the services you provide, the confidence the community has in what you're doing. We look very closely at this. Ironically, it was a very close call, but at the time, the chiefs felt that going with the county, which was touting a program then, regional. So it was like regional one or regional two. And historically, it didn't work out for Mayfield Village. But and I think one of the significant factors over time is that this program has expanded exponentially. And in terms, even then, we were looking at what the overhead would be for equipment, for just maintaining the level of services with all the tech requirements. So to see this today for the Metro Parks, I just think that everything about it objectively shows that it's going to provide a better quality of service, better predictability. Changing organizations is always tough. You have a sort of pride of ownership in your organization, and I would imagine that there's that psychological factor that has been a challenge, but typical with this organization, we've been very, very thorough. And it's a regional program that works. It's proven itself to work, and it keeps expanding, I think, which is evidence of its success, that it really is showing that there's one level of regional governance. For as much as we've talked about it in around Cuyahoga County for the last 20 years, this is a program that's successful. It actually works. So. I commend you for the effort to do it. It's always hard to make that change, but this looks like it's going to be very, very valuable, a very good move. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'd just like to add for the record that we, the commissioners, received several letters of public comment in addition to what we heard at the meeting last time, and we have read through those and followed up with questions with Chief Dolan and Brian. And I echo Bruce's thoughts that you've done a really thorough evaluation of this, and that while there will be some challenges, I'm sure, because we're doing something very significantly new and different, it seems that the backup abilities and the technology that's going to be offered to us is going to serve our park district rangers, officers, I'm sorry, as well as the community even better into the future. So I appreciate all the homework that's gone into this, and I agree, I think it makes a lot of sense, but I did want to note that we've taken these letters seriously and had follow-up discussions individually just to make sure we understood exactly what the impacts would be.
And again, I want to reiterate that as this transition transpires, myself will be part of the Council of Governments. So it's not just that we handed it off to somebody else and we're completely out of it.
Important.
I will be actively involved in it to make sure that, you know, our people that do decide to go will be taken care of and will be able to, you know, continue to be a part of what we have here. Chief will be part of her components as well. So, you know, at that level, this is a very unique blend. It isn't just handed off to somebody and we walk away.
Right.
We will be very active in making right. sure that, you know, all of the components, and we are diverse, we are different. We do serve five counties. We have a large geographic footprint. There are things that we want to make sure that are handled in the appropriate manner. That's why the police all got the chance to get through the facility. Our dispatchers got a chance. We really took the time to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately the taxpayers expect government to work well, and those expectations are generally not met. This is something that I think we're responsibly serving those interests. Thank you.
And before the recommended action, again, I want to thank each and every one of the dispatchers that has been working or has worked for Cleveland Metro Parks throughout their career.
Important. Thank you.
Recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 22 to enter into as a participating member of the Chagrin Valley Dispatch Council.
Move approval.
Seconded. On favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
As Chief leaves, we will move into the award of tabulation and bids. We only have one. It is the third party electric service. I'm going to have Bill just give a quick highlight of our third party electric service.
Sure. Thanks, Brian. This is this can be a little bit complicated, so we'll try and break it down pretty briefly. There's three components to electricity. There's generation, transmission, and distribution. We have two electric providers. We have Cleveland Public Power that handles admin building, zoo, and majority of the lakefront. And then we have a First Energy subsidiary, CEI, that handles the balance about 159 different meters throughout the parks. And with CPP, they handle the sourcing and pricing of the generation component. With the First Energy subsidiaries, we have the ability to work with a broker to market those and get the best rate on our own behalf, as opposed to CPP doing that for us. So we have a two-step process here where we would like to continue working with our existing broker and get into a new agreement with that individual, that firm. And then we would also like the ability to look at buying forward because energy rates are so strong right now. We currently have our rate contract through May of 2022, and we look to get a 4 to 5% decrease over the last 3-year average if we extend from 2022 to 2024. So that's a little bit of the backdrop here. We went to this scenario with using a broker in 2014 because the state of Ohio started a contract with First Energy Solutions, the then First Energy Solutions, and they did not, we did not aggregate enough use by location to fall into that program. You need 6 million kilowatt hours. We had that across all those 159 locations or meters, but they viewed us more of like a residential type setting because each of those meters was much smaller in terms of its individual capacity. And administratively, it didn't work out well for them. So we got into an agreement with a company called Alternative Energy Solutions, AES, in 2014 through 18. We still continue to work with them outside of a long-term agreement on a consulting basis, but there really hasn't been a ton that they've needed to do. What's important is now the electric companies are going out to auction to look forward at purchasing these new rates going forward. They do that every 3 years. So what was done in 2018 carried us through to 2022. So 2018 carried us through the rates that we locked in through 2022. And now they're going back out to market in 2021 to carry us through the 2024 period. And that's what we would like to do. We had opportunity to work with a consortium, Omnia, but we also took this chance to go out to the market and we talked to two other proposers from the broker perspective. And lowest and best continues to be alternative energy source. Their rate is 0.00075 per kilowatt hour. That gets tacked on to the kilowatt hour charge that we ultimately get from the market. The next competitor was Premier Power Solutions. They came in at 0.0008. Given the familiarity that we have with AES, the relationship, the quality of work that they've done, and the fact that their price is best, we would like to continue working with them. And we do break down the overall list of services that we will have in the agreement with them. One of which will be, as we look towards this next pre-purchase, if you will, of 24 months from 2022 through 2024, once we get into that agreement, we will reevaluate at least 12 months in advance of expiration on when we can buy forward again and whether or not that makes sense. We don't want to go out any longer than that because the current future pricing actually starts to go up if you go to 36 or 38 months as opposed to staying with the 24. So that's kind of our optimal spot. And like I mentioned, that's going to help us reduce these rates about 4 to 5% from where the 3-year average is. We have the ability to get into a fixed price agreement. That fixed price agreement right now, as of our last check on this, which was a little bit, it was late last week when we were pulling this information together, the 24-month rate per kilowatt hour was 0.4669, and that would project us at an annual savings of about $13,500 from where we're at today. Hmm. Now, we, that market.
0.04 though, right? 0.04.
Sorry?
0.04. You said 0.4.
0.04, excuse me, 0.04. Yes, thank you for that. It's a moving target, but it's not moving a lot. So this rate could be a plus or minus when we actually would go to market should this be approved, which would be 9:30 tomorrow morning. We don't expect it to change a whole lot from there. But based on all this, what we would like to do is lock into a fixed rate for the period of 2022 through 2024, and we would also like to lock into another four-year agreement with Alternative Energy Solutions as our third-party broker. So our recommended action is twofold. One, that we can enter into such agreement with the third-party broker Alternative Energy Source in accordance with the ANIA contract number. This is an independent firm. They're not part of the consortium, but they will comply with the consortium contract rules and regs on our behalf, and this will be for a four-year period of June 1, 2022 through May 31st, 2026. And then conversely, we would like to lock in a two-year fixed rate of the with a company called Energy Harbor for the generation component at a price of plus or minus 0.04669 per kilowatt hour for the period June 1, 2022 through May 31st, 2024. So that was a lot of background, but if there's any questions, I'm happy to address those. Otherwise, this is our recommended action.
Very stimulating.
No questions. Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor? Aye.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
The last item just to highlight is through the bids and services procured in the under 50, there is a unique one, the access study to the old Lorraine Road and Rocky River Reservation. This is actually being done by Cleveland Metro Parks with reimbursement from the City of Cleveland as a partnership. So just as a highlight. Vouchers and payroll.
The following vouchers totaling $8,855,729.63 have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure in conformity with the Ohio Revised Code. Therefore, the recommended action is that the Board of Park Commissioners approves this resolution number 20-09-119.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Public comments.
Okay, I'll be switching over to call-in user four, which it should be Marty. Okay, go ahead, Marty.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. Just to revisit my concerns regarding the Chagrin Valley Dispatch issue. Either commissioners are getting answers in private to some of the issues that have been raised, or you proceeded to vote on them without a closer look. Neither is good. I live in a township, and even here they manage to take a step back and table an item when new material comes to their attention. It is not only a reasonable approach, but is in fact the only proper way to assure weighing all effects. Yes, CVD had a lovely, polished, glossy layout which was shared almost verbatim. However, a fancy advertising presentation does not guarantee a good or well-suited product. Potential problems were dismissed. Regarding the board meetings themselves, first to say the audio today is much better, but given that deciphering what is said and by whom was still not improving after 5 months, I have shared my concerns with the Auditor of State. If Stillwater Place is hosting events, I wonder why the public can't be allowed to attend board meetings either at admin or at Stillwater Place. Apparently, the maximum of 10 people is not always enforced. And back to money. The change order, including the Whiskey Island fire line connection and new meter. Wasn't that fire line previously dealt with using the second Sandy grant? Excuse me. Even after some work before that, are we paying again for something? Seems as though, like Merlin's Wharf HVAC, it's had a lot of do-overs. Golf is apparently also doing well nationwide. Obviously good for Metro Parks income now, so we can't be sure it will carry forward when life goes back to normal and other opportunities return. The major drop in golf and golf cap equipment and construction alone gave $1 million boost. Are the employees who are assigned to work there, work share there at golf being charged back to golf? And how did the East 55th Marina fall behind when there were supposedly waiting lists to fill empty slots? As evidence from enterprise admin expenses, there are a lot of factors to keep track of. Granted, the tough times require tough decisions, still visitor numbers show their support and love of the basic back to nature park. When other attractions fade, it will still be there welcoming people. Thank you.
Just to clarify, the water main issue, Marty is putting two separate things together. And I take great offense to that. She needs to know the facts. This is the city of Cleveland's water line, not Cleveland Metro Parks water line, not Cleveland Metro Parks funds.
I'd also like to address the criticism that we are not following the orders of the state consistently. And in fact, that could not be farther from the truth. We are following all of the COVID-19 orders from the Department of Health, as well as the governor directives, very closely. Regarding events that are held at Stillwater, those events are bound by the banquet guidelines. The banquet guidelines allow for up to 300 people to gather in a banquet facility. And with additional restrictions and regulations, monitoring their presence within that facility, spacing of tables and whatnot. Our board meetings are bound by the general order, which prohibits gatherings of more than 10 people. We have combed all of the orders, as well as other organizations have done so, only to conclude that while conceptually there are some inconsistencies in how we're approaching public health issues, there is no legal basis for us to allow a gathering of more than 10 people in a business meeting. So that's why for all of our meetings, whether it's an internal meeting and whether it's our board meeting, we are following the state guideline of the limit on 10 people.
Thank you for the clarification. That's been my understanding as well. Do we have any other public comment? Very well, then information and briefing.
I will grab Harold for the diversity and inclusion update.
Ready?
The show is yours, Harold.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
I'm here to kind of give you an update on diversity and inclusion, and it's actually on the heels of us creating a new strategic plan. We have a consultant that's in place that is going to help us create a strategic plan, but I want to give you a little background on where we are and where I think we're going with the strategic plan, and then I think there's a good story to tell with the situation in Sean's McHugh's area where diversity and inclusion has come together to it's a very successful story. So to start off, I thought this quote was appropriate. It's 2020, and nothing has been normal in 2020. But when we seem to think we have everything under control, I don't think we're going fast enough. And that's indicative of these floods that we've had in the last several weeks. So let me start off by deviating from diversity a little bit, but it may have a sort of a spillover effect into diversity. So this year, recently, we've been given or earned the prestigious North Coast 99 award that we've won, I think it's 13 times, and it's in the last 9 years, so the year after Brian arrived, we went out and completed the application process, and we've won consecutive awards since then. But this is one of those special years that I want to highlight because we get a report from North Coast 99, and this year they actually provided percentages on this report. And so when you look at it, it's 99, it's about 350 organizations that apply for this award annually. And it's the top 99. So there's a rating system that they go through and they compare organizations against one another. And so these are our rate, our percentages in those categories this are for last year. So it's always the award is given for the previous year. So that's for 19 and you receive the award in 20. And the point I'm trying to make here is every year, we really don't know where we fall in the 99. And so I start questioning, where are we? I know a few years ago, I was able to solicit or to garner a little information related to, we were 15 out of the 99. So Yeah, that's impressive. When you talk about the Cleveland Clinics and the Cleveland States and the Metro Health and all these big organizations. So this year, we were number one. And the overall score, 93%. We were the recipient of the Award of Excellence. Unfortunately, we didn't have this big event that we, you know, Brian would go on stage and accept the award this year, but we were number one this year. And the one thing I want to point out is, and this has a linkage to diversity and inclusion, is they rated us very high when it came to our talent attraction, acquisition, and onboarding. And our onboarding process, we're very proud of. And I have to give a lot of credit to Edie, and she oversees the training for the organization. But back in 2012, shortly after I arrived, I went to Brian and I said, hey, I think our onboarding process is tragic. I think it's really bad. And I said, I want to spend a week down at Disney watching how they do it, because they are known as the best new hire onboarding process in the world. So I had the fortune of going down there for a week and looking at everything behind the scenes, and brought a lot of their stuff back. So it may look like a lot of it is my ideas, but I did steal a lot of things from Disney and brought it back up to Cleveland Metro Parks. And so we've been acknowledged for our onboarding process, which we should give some credit to Disney as well.
Define that term.
What's that?
What is onboarding?
Onboarding is the process of when a person, from the time they're interviewed to the time they show up, there's a process that takes place. And when they actually show up, there's a five-day process, orientation, but there's a five-day process that we take them through that we've linked each day to a core value. And so there's a theme each day. Brian does a few, he comes a few times a week, he kicks it off. I do something. All the chiefs are part of that process. So Bill does a presentation, and so they get to know everyone. And by the end of it, what I like about it is there's the manager, the new manager, and the employee will sit down at the end of the week, and they come up with a 90-day plan. So when that employee steps foot in the workplace or their location Monday, there's a plan in place of what they're going to do for the first 90 days. So it's not, where's the bathroom, here's your computer. They have a plan in place. So they hit the ground running, on the first day. So it's a structured process that we go through when we hire someone.
Did you have a question, Bruce?
No, sure. Thank you. That's very.
So let me shift gears a little bit and just touch on diversity, really at a 30,000-foot view at Cleveland Metro Park. So we think of diversity in the workplace as experiences, backgrounds, and things that come together to make the organization better. And actually, the picture that you see up there is the last onboarding session that we conducted before COVID-19 hit. So if you look at that picture, there's a diverse candidate pool there, or employee pool, that you see in that picture, but that is the last onboard. I think that's February, if I'm not mistaken.
Looks awful nice for February.
So in terms of diversity, I think, and inclusion, they look at you hear these things being used interchangeably, and there's a little difference between the two. And the way I like to look at it is, an organization can mandate diversity because it's about bringing candidates into the organization. The inclusion piece, you can't mandate the inclusion piece. The inclusion piece is about experiences, it's about backgrounds, it's about opening up your heart, opening up your mind to include the individuals that you bring into the organization. So the easiest way that I'm gonna use an analogy. The easiest way to remember this, in my opinion, is diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance once you get there. So you can be invited to the party, but if no one asks you to dance, you're not being included in the process. And that's why I have Sean McHugh here today, because I think he has a story to tell. That's what, 6 years? About 6 years? That where he has diversity and inclusion that sort of met together, and it's a very positive story. I'm I included this because I think it's important to look at the dimensions of diversity. I think there are different layers of diversity, and this really kind of explains the different dimensions. There's an internal, external, and an organizational component of diversity. Think about diversity like an iceberg. So there are things above the iceberg, above the waterline that you can see, and there are things below the waterline that you can't see because the iceberg extends well into the water. You only see a piece of the iceberg when it's hanging out of or above the water. This actually comes from a training session that back in 2018, we launched unconscious bias training, bias in hiring training for all of the staff in the organization. So this is actually a slide from the training that we brought in a consultant to provide unconscious bias training and bias in hiring training. So a little background. We had a diversity advisory council for many, many years. I think it dates back about 20 plus years. Back in 2012, there was a little break prior to 2012. There was a recommissioning of that committee. Dan Velosky, who's no longer here, was the chair of that committee. And so there was a strategic plan that came out of that. Now, 5-year strategic plan, some nice things were done in the organization, but we still knew that we had some work to do moving forward, especially when we're going into a levy in a couple years. So I went to Brian, I said, look, I think we need to have a refresh, a rebranding of the diversity committee. The idea concept was literally a conversation with Kelly Manderfield in the hallway. She put her creative people together, Danielle, Lindsay, Eric Hewitt, and Jeff Tolman, and this is where that came from. This idea concept came from the creative people in the organization, so I don't take any credit for that. It was a marketing project that they put together. We took it to the diversity committee at the time. They liked it, and so that's how this is the diversity advisory council sort of morphed into this idea committee. Do I click on it? And they also took the liberty of creating a small informational piece that we're going to roll out to staff. So a little background on the organization. You may, from time to time, you hear Brian mention how many employees we have in the organization, but currently it's 749 full and part-time employees. The breakdown of that is 443 male, 306 female. The goal there is to go 50-50. So it's about 60-40 now. And when I first arrived, and Brian will remember this, we had about 45% of the staff that could retire. And so we did see a lot of individuals retire shortly after, you know, in the next, I would say within 5 years of our tenure here. So now that has switched, because now you have 396 employees that have less than 10 years. So most of those employees were hired, you know, during this 10-year period. And so it's a different dynamic that we have in the organization just looking at 10 years ago. We do have a very high retention rate in the organization. We've averaged about 90% over the last 10 years. And I want to say currently we're about 96%. So that 90% probably had something to do with those individuals retiring of that, you know, 45% that retired within the 5 years that Brian and I were here.
That's 90% over the last 10 years. That's 90%, not 90% with 10 years or more.
No, that's 90% of people that when you look at, that's a turnover rate.
So we
average less than 10% turnover, which is really good.
That's great.
When you put it in layman's terms, when people start here, they usually stay because they like the organization, the mission, and just enjoy the work that they do. So from time to time, we look at where do we have opportunities for improvement. And just recently, not to pick on the police department, but we had to do a disparity study. They got a grant from the Department of Justice. And so in order to get the money, you have to show the Department of Justice the breakdown of your demographics in the organization. And one of the things that we notice in law enforcement in general, because we do this for all positions, but this is a recent example, is that this report basically states that we have to do a better job of hiring female officers and minority officers. And that's the problem that most communities have. That's not just indicative of Cleveland Metro Parks. And driving in this morning, I was thinking, you know, how do I talk about this? But, you know, I came from a law enforcement family. So my father, uncles, aunts, you know, there's a long line of people that went into law enforcement in my family. But then it dawned on me that next generation, not one of us went into law enforcement. And so you had this situation where the applicant pool skipped an entire generation because we were told that they wanted us to do something else and go to college and a number of things. But so the point I'm trying to make is that is a problem in law enforcement, that women and minorities, the pool is very narrow in terms of that. So we you know, part of our strategic plan is we're going to try to figure out how do we tap into those things, how do we get people to the organization. You know, sometimes it's our mission that drives people come into our organization. It's a different type of law enforcement. They're not Cleveland Police. There's a different approach to it. So can we upsell that type of job as opposed to traditional law enforcement? And by 2025, 75% of the workforce will be millennials. So we have to take that in consideration because they have a different mindset when it comes to work and what they're expecting of their employer. And my goal is the next strategic plan will address this, because we need to figure out and put things in place that accommodate or will compensate for what we need to do in terms of attracting millennials. So in terms of the next strategic plan, I think there are five critical areas. One is a leadership component to it, and engagement. I think there's a modeling piece to this that the managers and senior management have to model a certain behavior that cascades down through the organization. There's another piece, there's a workforce. It's we have to attract a diverse population to the organization. And there are various ways, and I think this ties back to the North Coast 99 award where we scored really high, is that we do a good job of attracting. We just got to find a way of getting to certain populations to get them, get our word out about Cleveland Metro Parks. There's a workplace piece. So the workforce is when you're external to the organization, you're coming into the organization. The workplace piece is once you're here, what do we do to make sure that you're placed in a situation that you're thriving? You're in an environment where you can thrive. And that's where I want to highlight some things where Sean has taken leadership and mentoring and sort of merged them together. The community piece is important as well. One of the things I believe leading up to the next levy is we're going to have to tap into underserved communities and figure out how we can get the Metro Parks to them as opposed to them coming to the Metro Parks. So we have to And one of the barriers that I believe that we're going to have to address is transportation, because, you know, our parks are not, and our facilities may not be on the best bus routes or public transportation routes. So we got to figure out how do we, and that's the same thing with employment, in terms of, we have some remote locations that need staff, but a lot of times they have transportation barriers that we can't get them there. So that's part of the strategic plan as well. And the last piece is the marketplace, where we have to make sure that our services and programs are suitable to all. And so, you know, whether it's the zoo or the parks, I've had these conversations with Joe and Chris, and they're real intimately involved in this, and so they will be part of the strategic plan as well. So shifting gears, this is the 2021 golf operations calendar cover. So this picture was taken a couple years ago, and I told Sean, I said, you need to create a calendar, because this is serious stuff here. But this is the golf operations construction crew. And so back in, I would say, 14 or 15, Sean came to me and said, look, I have this big irrigation project. So you've seen these pictures of Sean's golf courses all torn up, and, you know, he's putting this pipe in. What, you know, it's remarkable. You know, he brought all of that in-house and did it internally with the staff that you see here. And he said, I need labor on the golf course, because there's a big manual labor piece to this that I need some help with. So we reached out to Towards Employment and said, hey, here's what we need. So we partnered with Towards Employment. They sent us, what was it, about 12? Yeah. About 12 individuals, all African American. Am I true in saying all African American? And so they started working on the golf course. And so I'll turn it over to Sean now, because maybe he can talk through, you know, some of his experiences. And I think we have a good story to tell with one of the individuals that you see up there, Joe Norris right here.
Yeah, so when I went to Harold and said, you know, we got these projects lined up, and the thing that we're lacking, we have the knowledge and all the know-how how to do this, but we need the labor to help get us in it, get this stuff in the ground and go from there. So we ended up with these 12 individuals. And once they came on board, I realized that, you know, some of these guys were late 20s, early 30s, and this was their first job. They have never held a job. They got in trouble with the law and did different things, and they just never left their neighborhood, never. And, you know, a lot of them didn't make it. And as you can see, there's two of them up there. Joe Norris is the one fellow right by the bulldozer blade, and the other guy standing up real high, Mike Collins, made it out of that crew. And so we brought these guys in. They knew nothing, and we just started working with them and kind of showing them some things. And as we started working with them, you realize their lifestyle is a lot different than our lifestyle. And there was a lot of things that in life that they just didn't understand. You know, the whole idea of, you know, having car insurance and things like that, or how to get a mortgage or do things like that. So once you start hearing these stories and you start digging into their lives a little bit, you know, I personally felt compelled that, you know, it's up to me to help these guys along. We got to figure this out. We got to get, these are good guys. They're coming to work. They're coming, you know, starting at 5:30 in the morning and working in the hot sun all day. And so we're going to work with these guys and figure out what we can do to make them better people. And lo and behold, 6 years later, they're still here. The fellow in the front by the bulldozer blade, I got a great story about him. So we had sent him to, they both went to onboarding. And after the week of onboarding, I ran into one of Harold's people in the hallway, and they said, boy, it was great meeting your irrigation specialist. And I was racking my brain standing there in front of this person trying to figure out who my irrigation specialist is, because I don't have one. And so then all of a sudden they said, oh, Joe. And I got back to the project, and I pulled Joe aside. I said, Joe, what's this title of irrigation specialist? And he goes, Sean, he goes, I'm in a room with a bunch of people and everybody's got a title. He said, when they got to me, he goes, I wasn't going to tell them I was the ditch digger. He said, I just stood up and said, you know what? I'm an irrigation specialist. And to this day, Brian, everybody that knows Joe knows him as our irrigation specialist. And that's who he is, you know. And these guys have done well. Mike Collins, the guy up high on the bulldozer, is a full-time job at Euclid Creek doing great out there. Joe is still happy working with us in golf. And, you know, he's expanding his horizons by we're training him with a lot of other things in turf management besides just doing construction. So it's really turned on and done well. But to go back to the 12 people that we had, you know, one day Harold talked about transportation. These guys would take buses. And so some of them were coming from the east side. And when I talked to them, they said, you know, they were leaving their house at 2:30 in the morning because they had to get a bus down to, you know, Center City or downtown, and then get a bus out to Brecksville. And then from Brecksville, when they get off at Brecksville Road and sleepy, it's a 3-mile walk to Seneca. So then I started setting up that one of our full-time guys would meet them at the bus stop with a truck, and we would transport them down. At the end of the day, we'd get them back. But then on a couple of days, it was pouring raining at the end of the day. So I threw these guys in my truck, and we looked like a bunch of migrant farm workers going somewhere. And I drove them down to downtown to get the bus so they could get home a little quicker. But on that ride, it really came true of, you know, how sheltered or the life they live. I heard the one young fellow in the backseat of the truck talking to another one and said, man, they got trees in their yard. Isn't that nice? And then he said to the other guy, one guy says to the other, says, how do you think they get these houses? Do you think they rent to own? So then this turned into a lesson on, no, you're not going to rent alone. You know, you're not going to go to the Rent-A-Center to get a TV. You got a good paycheck. Wait 2 weeks. Get that money. Go to Walmart. Buy the TV. You own the TV. Then we got into talking about checking. And because they were going to check cashing places and cashing their check, and half their money was going to this check cashing place. So we got into, no, we're going to get you into the bank. You're going to open up an account for $20, and you're going to have an account here now. And then this check is a good check. You go in there every Friday, and you cash this check. You get all your money. Everything you work for, you get now. So it was them type of things that we were dealing with that we just take for granted that no one would think that way. And here they are, and they just needed a hand. But transportation, like I'll agree with Harold, you know, to keep this going, to draw some of these people, we're going to have to figure out some transportation because the buses aren't easy for them, you know, to get to our properties. And especially like us in golf, we start so early in the morning, you know, to get going. It's tough for them to get there. But it's a great story, and these are two wonderful people that we have now that work for us. So we've been blessed with them. So it's turned out real well. So
thanks.
Joe Norris about his experiences with Cleveland Metro Parks.
So irrigation
that's him right there. So I've never heard anyone refer to Sean McHugh as chill up until this point. I just want to go on record to say that I don't know if that's a valid statement, but it's a good success story where, like I say, diversity and inclusion kind of met up, because Dave and Sean, you know, they made sure he was in a situation to thrive. So I'm not sure that you're going to, you know, see the level of involvement that you see in other parts of the organization when it comes to this situation. Like Sean really, you know, took the lead on this. But I think it's a good example of how, you know, sometimes people need a little help, a little guidance, and he's been a success story. I think his son just went off to Heidelberg?
Yep.
Heidelberg College. And so he's, you know, last time I ran into him, he was very proud of his son going off to college. So I think it's generational changing, because, wow, you know, he saw his father go off, you know, work for the last 6 years, and then, you know, he's encouraged his son to go off to college, so his son's playing football for Heidelberg. So any questions? I just, again, we'll have a new strategic plan in 2021, and so I'll be up here again at some point to report out on that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to say there, I think there was a video, an audio issue with our, so the public couldn't hear the videos. So we'll post those on the website so the public can hear the actual audio of the two videos that were shared during this presentation. Thank you.
All right. As Sean and Harold leave, you will have Sarah and Sean join us, and this is planning for East Side Trail Connections update.
Hello.
Welcome, Sarah. Welcome, Sean.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I am just going to run through briefly to give some background on our East Side Trail planning process. Next month, we're going to come back and talk about West Side, so just chunking it down right now. And as you know, some of this is going to be a little bit of a refresher on some of the planning processes that we've done and some of the projects that we've talked to you about already. But we're led by some major planning studies, the Eastside Greenway, Cuyahoga Greenways, and then on an Eastside focus, the Eastside Lakefront Greenway plan that was done in 2015. The Eastside Greenway, as I mentioned as well. And then we're gonna be influenced also by some upcoming large scale regional transportation for livable communities initiative studies that NOAACA is sponsoring. The Downtown Cleveland Transportation Study and Regional Lakefront Transportation Connection Study were just approved last week with the NOAACA board. So those are going to be starting up. And then the Metro Parks Connection Study is forthcoming. They haven't put out an RFP for that yet. So these are things that we kind of build our planning program around, along with our reservation master projects and other things, master plans and things that we do internally. But we're also working collaboratively with the larger community for these trail connections. So Cuyahoga Greenways, again, it was completed in 2019, large participation throughout the entire county, and it also incorporated the Eastside Greenway plan. And just a little look at it, this is a long-range framework for building connections throughout the county and cross county as well. So we identified through this planning process, critical gaps, regional links, key routes, and other supporting areas. I'm just gonna focus in on a few of the trails, but some of the ones I'm not talking about today, because we've talked about them before, Sagamore Connector that you can see right here, Brecksville to Bedford, the Richmond Road little tiny gap that's there that we talked about last month, and then also the Chagrin de Solon Trail over here. So, but I'm gonna focus in on some major projects. As you can see, we've talked about this before with some of the major projects that have happened over the last few years or are underway right now, Towpath, Lakefront West, and our Tiger Trails. There's a lot over on the west side, and Opportunity Corridor Trail going in with that ODOT project. That's the total inclusive price, but you can see that it's been very west side focused. And so we want to look at some of our east side trails and build out the network over east of the river as well. So Slavic Village Downtown Connector, which you've heard about a couple of times over the last few months, and also Booth Avenue Connector. These are two of the major trail projects. And the Booth Avenue Connector down here, you can see it's a pretty critical point. We've got our Garfield Reservation, there's bike lanes on Warner Road and connects to our Mill Creek Connector Trail down here, gets you down to the towpath. And then we've got our trail that goes up to Washington. These are two very critical pieces to get access between the towpath trail, our reservations, and downtown Cleveland. And you can see this piece right here is the Morgana Run Trail that was completed in 2008. And so it's a great facility, but it doesn't connect to a whole lot. So other than within the community getting back and forth. So this would provide these two trail projects would provide that linkage to get between the reservations, get more fully through the neighborhood and into downtown Cleveland. And as we spoke about before, this project is partially funded through NOACA with construction dollars, the Slavic Village Downtown Connector, that is. We have put money towards it as well. We are waiting right now on an alternatives evaluation report that ODOT is doing for an I-77 shoulder widening and drainage project. We can't really move forward with any preliminary engineering until that study is done. It was originally set to be done around August, September, but with COVID, it got delayed until November of 2020. And ODOT is organizing a meeting with all stakeholders in November to go over the results of that study so we can better move forward on the downtown connector. So that's just an update to that project. And then the Booth Avenue Connector, there's a group that has formed through Slavic Village Downtown or Development Corporation and Union Miles, as well as National Park Service. They're looking at a community engagement process to move this project forward. So the Booth Avenue Connector, again, just a very short little stretch of trail, but very critical to link up our facilities to the Morgana Run Trail and then on to Slavic Village Downtown Connector. There was a meeting that Union Miles and Slavic Village coordinated for September 2nd, and they're kicking off their engagement process for that with the idea that you're getting some more eyes on this project, getting some momentum behind it, and then moving it forward. So we are actively participating in that planning effort as well. And just to look at some of the current conditions for that Booth Avenue underpass and some renderings of what it might look like in the future. So we'll keep you updated on that as well. The Euclid Creek Greenway, kind of a busy map here, but we've been looking at this corridor for a number of years and we're starting to pick off pieces of it to work on. There was a ride that was coordinated through City of Cleveland and our staff, a group bike ride to look at these different alignments that was held on September 3rd. And we're working with the City of Cleveland to advance this project in their capital improvement plan as well. But there's a lot of challenges in this corridor, so we all need to kind of come together and get the best route pinned down and look at to the future to fund the rest of this very important connection that, you know, the idea to connect the lakefront portion of the Euclid Creek Reservation and the lower portion of Euclid Creek Reservation predates us, you know, taking over the lakefront in 2013. This has been part of the statewide trails plan for years, decades. So we are now trying to push that forward. And as you know, we do have funding. We'll be going to construction in 2022 for the first phase of the Euclid Creek Greenway. So that's connecting from the end of our all-purpose trail, taking you up to Euclid Avenue to what will be the former Euclid Central Middle School site. And that'll be the transition to the next phase of the Euclid Creek Greenway. But we've been actively working on it. And then this is a rendering of potential for a Euclid Central Middle School site. So right up here, so that's kind of going north. This is that section. So this is Euclid Avenue right here. maintaining parking in the front for this facility, but demolition is going to be moving forward on this building this fall. And as you remember, Euclid City Schools passed a bond issue a few years ago to consolidate some of their school facilities, and this is a no longer needed facility, so it's being demolished through the City of Euclid and the school board, and then it'll come back to Cleveland Metro Parks because we actually had previously owned part of this site and had given it over to, sold it to the school board back in the 50s. But this is going to be an important extension point for the trail and an area to naturalize. You've got very great views from the site back to the escarpment and just the main part of the reservation. So this will be for a future phase going forward. And then finally, I'm just going to talk about the...
that plan.
Jeez. Yeah. Does that look familiar? Do you still see that in your dreams? But the City of Cleveland, the Waterfront District Plan passed in 2004, sorry. You can see that there's, this is a very aspirational plan with a lot of guidance for basically development over the course of decades for the Cleveland Lakefront. There has been movement on portions of this. One of the key pieces, though, is getting the connections for the Cleveland Lakefront Bikeway. It is a signed route between East 9th and East 55th, where you can then transition East 55th through the parks onto an all-purpose trail. But this piece between East 9th and East 55th could be greatly improved.
Obviously, has the support currently of the county executive, of which Metro Parks has worked with all the leaseholders of the different yacht clubs. We have just been stifled by the City of Cleveland at this point in time.
So, and we do work from a lot, as I mentioned in the very beginning, we work collaboratively through the planning process and are executing on a lot of past plans. And so it's important to us to make sure that we're working in partnership and to execute these complicated projects that you really need to have multiple parties come to the table and work through. So back in 2015, the Lakefront Greenway and Downtown Connector study was completed. This was a City of Cleveland sponsored study, Transportation for Livable Communities Initiative study, and in concert with the CDCs in the area. And one of the major pieces of this was looking at a trail along, an all-purpose trail along the north marginal as well as the south marginal. So again, this is a huge critical piece of the transportation network that could greatly be improved. And just some information from that study, these are images from the study from 2015, looking at North Marginal Road right now, and then what North Marginal could be. And you are constrained with right-of-way through there, and especially along Burke Airport, but those are things that we can work through together with our partner organizations to move forward so that this trail could become a reality. And again, it is part also of that Cuyahoga Greenways plan, a very important piece when you're looking at the entire lakefront and getting trail access through the lakefront. So hopefully that NOAACA TLCI process with looking at the downtown connections as well as the regional lakefront connections will again assist this project to move forward. So that's just a brief recap of some of the east side projects that we're working on. And as I said, a lot of these are big projects. These are things that we have to work in partnership with many other organizations, and we're just trying to push forward. So I'll come back next month and talk about some of the west side projects as well.
Thank you.
I do have a question, Sarah. So mm-hmm. The TLCI that just got initiated through NOAACA for the lakefront,
mm-hmm.
How is that different than the Eastside Greenways? I mean, is it going to the next level? Obviously, it's focused on the lakefront, not the whole east side, but what does it intend to do that the Eastside Greenways study didn't do?
I think it's just putting it into a larger framework. Since NOAACA has a five-county area, it's looking at Lorain, Cuyahoga, and Lake County.
East-west a lot further than obviously Cuyahoga County.
Yeah, and also with the TLCIs, the program's been around for about 15 years now, and there's a lot of smaller scale TLCIs. So this is an effort with these three regional plans that NOAACA is doing. It's an effort to stitch all those together, take their best parts, And so there's going to be a lot of, like the Cuyahoga Greenways plan, since we put a lot of detail into that, that's not going to be thrown out. That's going to be incorporated. Right. And they haven't worked out the scope yet, or we haven't been privy to the full process that's going to be used to see if maybe there's going to be some smaller areas that they're going to go into more detail along the lakefront. I would think.
But does that also have budget impacts that they're looking to leverage dollars long-term?
Oh, I'm sure. Because if you have a concerted kind of effort and agreed upon priorities to then go after funding. Yeah.
And even for their own TLCI funding now, they have implementation.
Bingo, yeah.
Right.
Study first to be able to then use.
And additionally, NOAACA is going through their long-range transportation planning process right now to be approved next spring. And so that'll be the guide map for the next 20-plus years for NOAACA. So, okay. All right, thank you.
Great update, Sarah. Thank you so much. There is no other information, briefing, or policy item. There is no old business. The date of the next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, October 15th, and there is no executive session.
Motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn the meeting.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Go in peace. Be safe.
Thank you, guys.